Once upon a time, young people learned about the birds and the bees as a way to understanding human sexuality. It was about us, not them. Now it's a lot more about them, the pollinators, and their needs and skills. The many stories of widespread bee deaths have created concern where there was none a few years ago. Today we get a chance to visit with someone who studied pollinators extensively. Dr. Gabriela Chavarria is considered an expert on pollinators, and she works right here in our area at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Forensics Lab based in Ashland. So good to have somebody with as much knowledge as you have about bees to visit us, Dr. Chavarria. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me.
So you've been central to pollinator knowledge, it sounds like. I mean, how long have you been studying them?
Oh, gosh. All my life, feels like.
Mm-hmm.
I came to the United States almost 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I came from Mexico, and I did my college degree on Africanized honeybees. So I've always been fascinated by bees since I was very little.
That's a great subject area to start with because, you know, what we now call Africanized honeybees, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, we were calling killer bees. We thought they were going to come over the border and attack us in swarms. And obviously, those were slightly overblown fears. But so what happened to Africanized bees? Why did they not become as big a threat as we had
tried? Well, you know, Africanized bees, they are here. Mm-hmm. They are in the United States. They're in the Arizona, Texas, Florida, California, New Mexico. But, you know, the biggest limitation they have is the weather. These bees need flowers all year long. So our winters are very harsh on them. Flying all through South America, Central and Mexico, there's areas where there's flowers all year long. So that's why, you know, their popularity as killer bees became apparent. But we still have, you know, in the South, we do have some issues and incidents with swarmings because, you know, they reproduce and they're looking for places to migrate because that's in their nature. But the weather is a huge limitation.
So when you look at the just the general landscape of bees, particularly in the western United States, are things very different from what they looked like maybe 30 years ago or so?
Oh, absolutely.
How so?
Absolutely. You know, habitat destruction and the way we cultivate our crops in the west and midwest of the United States. 30 years ago, you know, sustainable agriculture was just a concept, something that people wanted to do more and more, and industrialized agriculture was all over. And, you know, through the years, we've learned that, you know, sustainable agriculture is the way to go, but it's taking us, you know, a hard lesson. And, you know, at the end of the day, we like to eat, and we need to find food, and in most cases, cheap food that we can eat. So the landscape has changed tremendously. And it's changed also in the fact that a lot of the food that we eat today doesn't require the services of pollinators that, like, you know, we used to 30 years ago. A lot of our crops and food that we eat now, you know, they have been genetically modified, so they don't require the services of a lot of these pollinators.
Okay, so do they do the pollination themselves, or is it just not necessary? Or
yeah, it's not necessary. The plant itself auto-pollinates, or, you know, you have to grow a new plant every year.
Okay, so in industrial agriculture, then, what you're saying is it's pollination not nearly as important as it would be otherwise. I mean,
correct.
In the food system, naturally, pollinators, it sounds like, are, what's the number? Somewhere between 70 and 90% of foods naturally are pollinated.
Almost 90%.
Almost 90%. It is
almost
that high.
Almost 90%.
Okay.
I mean, just a good example, unfortunately, it's an introduced crop, but almonds down south in California, you know, they require the services of pollinators, and they require the services of specifically honeybees that, you know, that pollinate almonds. So we have an introduced species pollinating an introduced species. But, you know, it's a relationship that needs to happen. We all love almonds. So, you know, it's a process that we have come to accept.
We're talking about bees with somebody who knows them very well, Dr. Gabriela Chavarria, trained under E.O. Wilson at Harvard University as part of her PhD program. She now works at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Forensics Lab in Ashland. She doesn't get to work on bees there, but the knowledge still remains. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange. Let's get your questions about bees and pollinators generally on the air at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. You just mentioned honeybees, which gets into the usual question that I end up scratching my head over every time, it seems like. Honeybees and bumblebees and any other general realms that exist and what the differences are.
Well, you know, first of all, in the United States, we have over 4,000 native species of bees.
Wow.
Most of them are solitary in behavior. Mm-hmm. And of those 4,000, we probably have over 500 species alone in Oregon. So we live in a very rich area. And of those, many of them are solitary in behavior. They live alone. They don't live in hives like bumblebees or honeybees. Bumblebees are native to the United States. Honeybees came from Europe. They were introduced. They're almost native because they've been here, you know, centuries with us. So the majority of the solitary bees, in fact, all of the solitary bees do not sting. They're stingless. But bumblebees do sting. They live in colonies. But actually, the colony starts as a single individual. The queen comes out of hibernation in the spring and then builds her nest. And then at the end of the season, the colony shifts to reproductives, the queen's mate, and then they go into hibernation. Honeybees, no. Honeybees, you know, they live socially all year long and for several years. And so the main difference is that a honeybee has a stinger that has barbs at the end. So when they sting, that barbs get attached into your skin.
And stays there.
And it stays there.
Mm-hmm. And does that kill the bee?
It kills the bee because it's the whole bottom of the bee stays in your body. And then in the case of bumblebees, they have a stinger that is smooth. It's kind of like a needle. So they can keep stinging you many, many times. But the chances that a bumblebee will sting you are really, really rare. In fact, their original name, when they were first described in their 1600s, it was humblebee.
Oh, really?
Yes. So they're very humble, and, you know, they can hardly fly when you see them. And, of course, you know, if you touch them or if you go to their nest, they will be very aggressive because they're very protective of their young. But otherwise, you know, they're totally, totally harmless.
I was going to ask where the bumble came from, and that's the answer. It used to be humblebee, and it got messed up in somebody's spelling, it sounds like.
Well, but it's a bumble because, you know, they're kind of like big and chubby.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, the name is appropriate.
So do all bees pollinate or
all bees pollinate. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. All of them pollinate because they feed on pollen and nectar. We can call them vegetarian. Mm-hmm. They only feed on pollen and nectar. So as they go and feed for themselves, they are collecting pollen. They're moving pollen from flower to flower. They're collecting nectar. And then, you know, they bring back the nectar and the pollen for their young.
So that raises the question of whether they're really consciously doing things to help the plants. It sounds like it's self-interest that just ends up being something that's beneficial to another species.
Well, it's self-interest to both species because, you know, plants need to create all of these amazing, incredible adaptations to attract the specific pollinators. So, you know, and in many cases we have plants, many native plants that have this mutualistic association with one species of bee. So if that bee doesn't pollinate that plant can die. And if on the same token, if that plant doesn't survive, the bee will not have the right food to survive. So we have these incredible adaptations that we've seen in the natural world. So they're, you know, they're both selfish because they're all trying to survive.
So there's specificity in both directions. The plant that makes itself attracted to one kind of bee or one kind of bee goes to the one kind of plant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you have, of course, you know, a lot of the generalists. Bumblebees are very generalists. Mm-hmm. Whatever you put in front of them, they will go and pollinate. They don't care. They like to eat, so they eat absolutely everything. But we do have a lot of them that just very specifically focus on certain kinds of plants. That's why it's so important to have native gardens and native plants to promote that, because there's so many little bees that, you know, they come out and they're looking for the right food. And, you know, if we're not planting the right food, you know, they will not survive.
We're talking to Dr. Gabriela Chavarria, who is with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Forensics Laboratory in Ashland. Her expertise, though, as you can tell, is in bees, and that's the subject matter here in the exchange. 800-838-3760 if you'd like to join the discussion. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. How did you end up? I mean, I can't imagine there's a lot of bee work going on at the forensics lab, so how did you end up there?
No, there's no bee work at the forensics. I ended up there because I was working in Washington, D.C., working in the office of the director as his science advisor, which was an amazing role. But I miss the science. I miss the research. And I was fortunate enough that I had a little bit of expertise on a totally different topic, wood anatomy of all things. Uh-huh. And, you know, and the lab was starting to work a lot of cases on the illegal trafficking of tropical hardwoods. Mm-hmm. So, and one of our analysts in the lab was looking for a taxonomist and a wood anatomist to complement a lot of the work that they were doing with chemistry to analyze a lot of these tropical hardwoods.
You're looking for little scraps of wood sometimes, I understand that.
Chemically, because every wood, every tropical, every species of tree has their own specific signature, chemical signature. So, but that's another story.
Mm-hmm. Okay, right. You're back to bees, which thanks for redirecting me. So give us an idea of the state of bees, because certainly after the die-offs in northern Oregon 3 years ago or so, it just seemed like everybody's attention got focused on how many bees can often die at one time. What's the general state, would you say, of well-being of bees?
Well, you know, bees fluctuate. Their populations fluctuate all the time. And it all depends on, you know, the availability of food and the use of, you know, pesticides or not pesticides, habitat destruction or not. And but, you know, we see these fluctuations constantly. And, you know, of course, climate change is causing a huge impact on them because they're, you know, they come out of hibernation and, you know, it's too early or it's too late and the flowers already flower. So the cycles are, you know, constantly changing. But we are losing a lot of bees. Particularly, you know, it draws attention because honeybees live in colonies. Their colonies have thousands of individuals. So when those individuals don't have enough food to eat or they get poisoned by pesticides, you know, it really catches the attention. But if you think that, you know, these thousands of honeybees are dying at the same time, imagine all of these other thousands of solitary bees that, you know, nobody's really paying attention to them.
So do those bees, do the solitary bees ever live, I mean, do they live for long in family units or they just hatch and go?
Well, actually, they live solitary. Mm-hmm. They like to have their own little hole, nest. Some of them just individually alone, they like their hole. But in a lot of the cases, you know, they like to have their own home, but they like to live in a community. Hmm. And I'm sure many of you have, you know, carpenter bees in your porch. Mm-hmm. And each hole is a little hole for one bee, but you know they like to feel that they have a community around.
Not a hive, but a neighborhood.
It's just a neighborhood,
yeah.
Because each hole is one bee, and each bee is, you know, growing their own little brood for that specific species. And you see that, you know, on the ground, a lot of these native species live on the ground. You know, they love, you know, mulch, on mulch areas, or underneath the mulch, they find places where they can nest. So they're very clever. Mm-hmm. And they are now, you know, there's a lot of commercial condominiums that you can put in your trees, you know, to attract and to provide habitat for a lot of these species. And like I said before, they don't sting. So, you know, you're just providing a habitat. But yes, we are losing a lot of bees.
Let's take some calls. Grab your headphones and let's invite to the Jefferson Exchange Nicole in Ashland. Thanks for joining us.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Oh, hello. Thank you so much, Doctor, for all your information about bees. In the last few minutes, I've learned a lot. I've always loved bees, and I've never been stung by one. As a child, I used to rescue them from swimming pools and things, and they never, ever stung me. And I always wondered why bees were so, people were so afraid of bees. The only time I've ever been stung were by two wasps in my whole life, and one, they had made a nest in my recycling, and when I opened the lid, one stung me, and then another time I stepped on one, so that's quite reasonable. But pollinators are so important, and I really feel that bees sting out of fear, or any animals attack out of fear of humans, because humans are the main predators on Earth toward any kind of other life form. So I just wondered what your take on this is. And thank you so much for all your information.
Thanks for the call, Nicole. Appreciate that. So why do bees sting, when they sting?
Well, they be, first of all, let me clarify something. I love bees the same as you do. And I wanted to differentiate between bees and wasps.
Okay, good point.
Because bees and wasps are very different. Even though they're related, they're cousins. Bees, like I said before, they're vegetarian. They feed on pollen and nectar, and wasps are strictly carnivores. So, and that's why they come to your picnic table, because they want a little piece of your ham sandwich.
Yellow jackets are wasps, aren't
Yellow jackets are wasps.
Okay.
So, and in their nature, you know, even us humans, you know, we have in our nature to protect ourselves and to protect our young, our child. So bees do exactly the same thing. The minute that they feel that somebody's been aggressive to them, they immediately have that behavior. But it's the same with any kind of, you know, animal that you will find. They will protect their brood. And bees, you know, they have a specific behavior that they will do anything for the benefit of the colony. And that is, they die. Because after they sting, they're altruistic.
Mm-hmm.
They're
altruistic
societies that, you know, they will die for the benefit. So it's in their nature. But like you said, you know, if you are totally help them, they feel if you are aggressive or not towards them. And even just waving your hand when you have a bee in front of you, that's an aggressive behavior. So if you just ignore it, they eventually will go away, I promise you.
Okay, so that's the good story on what to do when they're approaching us. We're talking to Dr. Gabriela Chavarria here on the Jefferson Exchange. He's a bee expert, now working at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Forensics Lab in Ashland. A couple minutes left for phone calls at 800-838-3760 by phone and by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Mark in Reading. Welcome to the Exchange.
Good morning.
Hi.
Years ago, when mites were the big problem with honeybees, a woman somewhere in the United States claimed that you could use a mixture of fennel and mint grown around your hives, and that would prevent mites. And everybody that was in the whole thing said, well, that's really interesting, lady, and bring on the miticide. And I'm wondering if there's anything to that story about her being able to prevent mites with the planting of fennel and mint around the hives.
Well, let's find out. Thanks for the call, Mark.
Well, I heard about that, and like that, you know, there's so many home remedies that people, particularly that if you have your own beehives, that used to, you know, to prevent the mites. Unfortunately, you know, many of the commercial hives, you know, when you have thousands of hives, you know, you go with an industrialized way to protect your hives against mites. So there's a lot of remedies, and, you know, it depends on, you know, the different beekeepers, how they apply it. But a lot of, you know, the critical thing is to keep monitoring a lot of your beehives so that way you prevent the mites.
So what are the signs of danger then? I mean, what are the signs of lack of health in beehives?
Well, you will see the bees are extremely clean, particularly, I mean, all of them are clean. Honeybees have, you know, their sanitation workers that, you know, every day they're moving detritus, they're moving everything unwanted. Particularly in mites, some of the mites that we see in the country, Varroa, it's a pretty big mite. You can see it with your eyes. So you can see some of these bees, you know, carrying some of these mites if you are monitoring your hives every day. So you can prevent it because you can see those mites in your colony. Or when you see that the population number is being reduced, that means there's something happening in your hive.
So if people do want to help, and we certainly hear this from a lot of people, it's like, well, what can I do to help the pollinators? And it's not just practices, but also talking about providing habitat. If somebody has enough land to do so without getting their neighbors upset with them, what kinds of things can people do to encourage pollinators to visit and take up residence?
Well, like I was talking about, you know, grow native plants. We have, you know, in Oregon and in all of the West Coast, every state has garden clubs. They have native plant societies that are extremely active. We're very fortunate here in Southern Oregon. We have the Extension Agricultural Master's Program, which are extremely active in bringing back a lot of these native plants. And even, you know, just letting little patches of these wildflowers in your yard, in your garden, that's a big help. The other thing is, don't plant anything that says pollen free. There's a big movement that, you know, when you go to retail stores to buy plants, you know, in most instances, they, you know, they said pollen free, because we think that, you know, allergies are due to the plants. But in reality, the pollen that a flower produces is minimal. minimal. So make sure you have, you know, pollen in your flowers. And then I was telling you about these, you know, little condominiums, mm-hmm. these pieces of board with different kinds of holes. You can go into websites and just research big condominium. You can create it yourself. You can buy it. You can put it in your yard to create a pollinator habitat. If you have mulch or areas in your gardens that, you know, just don't touch it. Let it rest, because a lot of the bees will nest underneath.
So it sounds like if you've got any skills at all with a couple of pieces of wood and a drill, you can probably make
a
bee condominium.
Yes.
Interesting, though, that you talk about the pollen-free plants, because here the needs of people conflict with what the needs of the bees are. And if you're looking for pollen-free because you're afraid for your allergies, not great for the pollinators.
No, but, you know, the amount of pollen that these flowers produce, you know, is minimal. And it's usually, you know, when you get close to the flower, you will see that the pollen is not flowing freely like, you know, tree pollen. That, you know, it just rains pollen.
Right, like the pine trees.
So this is just very minimal. So it's really not causing your allergies.
Let's talk about some individual species, because I remember reading, probably 5 or 10 years ago now, about the Franklin bumblebee. The Franklin bumblebee that is native to southern Oregon and apparently has not been seen by anybody.
Has not been seen from anybody in decades.
Really, that long?
And then, you know, there is the big effort from Robin Thorpe down at the University of California in Davis that comes every year with a whole group of volunteers trying to monitor and look for Bombus franklini, and we have not been lucky enough to refine it. But we still have, you know, close to 18 other species that live here in Oregon that we can help promote.
Is there one plant above all others that if, you know, people just don't know, they just want to throw something in the garden and get started, what's a good place to start with the plants?
Well, everything that flowers, you know,
really?
From lavenders to daisies to sunflowers, everything that has a lot of pollen. And even herbs, you know, if you can plant a big herb garden and leave some to flower, I know the pollinators will appreciate that.
I forgot about the lavender part. Yes, there's lots of lavender planted in my neighborhood. When I rub my hands against the lavender, I got to check first to make sure I'm not going to be taking any bees.
And deer
along with
doesn't
me.
Like lavender.
Deer doesn't like it. Oh, that's a good thing to know.
Because that's the other thing. Around here, we need to watch for deer.
Wow. We could pick your brain, I think, for hours, but we're out of time now. Can you come back sometime?
Absolutely.
Okay. Dr. Gabriela Chavarria is at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Forensics Lab in Ashland and clearly an expert on bees and pollinators. Thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you very much.